You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Arundhati Roy, winner of this year's Booker Prize for her novel, The God of Small Things. It's her first novel. It's published by Random House. The book was published almost to an immediate sense of surprise. The word spread from the earliest book auctions to its publication in America, which was heralded by a special and beautiful reader's edition, at which time I've read it. I've been wanting to talk to Arundhati Roy since I read the book, and I'm very glad to have you here.
Thank you, Michael.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, the book has a very unusual structure. It's as if the whole thing pours from an empty or a set of empty holes. There's the empty hole vacated by a boat in which the children's mother and her lover make love once the boat has been dug up. There's the empty hole from which the twins come from their mother into the world. And there's this enormous sense of vacancy, with as if the world is filled from an initial emptiness. And I wanted to start there.
Well, you know, when I write, it's not as if I start with a theoretical concept or that I have any kind of agenda. And often these things are motives that repeat themselves, which I myself can't explain. You know, I always say that when a writer writes a book, she lays her weapons down, and it's, you know, people will make what they will of it. But the structure of the book is something which, for me, was among the most challenging things, because I'm a student. I studied architecture, and I don't know whether it's because of that or not, but to me, the bones of the story were so important, the balance of it and how it works. And there are two or three things that are very important to me about this book. One is, I mean, there are many things, but I'm just talking about the structure. One of them is the fact that in many ways, the structure of the book ambushes the story that it tells, because it doesn't begin, you know, at the beginning and end at the end in terms of its narrative. So really, the book ends in the middle of the story. And therefore, you know, though you know this, that the love story part of it is a doomed event, the fact that it ends with Amu and Velitha together, what it really tells you is that though what happened to them is tragic, the fact that they were together at all is wonderful, you know, so that it sort of wrings hope even out of tragedy. And it therefore never offers you one feeling at a time. It sometimes offers you completely contradictory emotions, which is something that I feel a lot. I can never settle on one emotion or one reaction to something. It's always complex, and I can argue myself into contradictory positions all the time.
One of my favorite things about the book is that it is largely constructed out of the invented thought language of children and a certain kind of baby talk evolves in the book. It reminded me a bit of a French film called Forbidden Games, in which children trying to understand the death of their parents in the war invent games in which things appear and disappear, and death is not in their world, but disappearance, magic, is. And to some extent, the magical world seems to be more coherent than the actual one in this novel, The God of Small Things.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because one of the things which I struggle against nowadays is people who wish to define this work as a work of magic realism. And I just reject that description of it, because you're right. The fact is that for the children, magic is real. And it isn't the author concocting magical situations or, you know, situations which are not perceived to be real by people, by adults. It is really an accurate language that is developed by children who do move between worlds that are perceived to be real and worlds that are imaginary with ease. And so, you know, whatever is magic is in the book is only generated by them, not by me as the writer. And the fact is that Estepan and Rahel are twins who grew up on the edge of this very parochial, closed community that does not offer them the assurances that it would people that live in the heart of it. And so they are constantly trying to anticipate what the world will do to them. And in doing that, develop a language.
Arundhati, can you help me? I sensed in the book that there was a disorganized and chaotic world which the children are at home in, and then there's a world of adult agendas which the children have to adapt to, and that somehow these two worlds are bridged by the appearance of desire, that in the movie theater there's a man who hungers to be touched by the young boy, that always desire seems to be the grounds by which adults impinge upon children, or the wakening of desire in children is the approach of the adult and frightening world. But I know I'm not phrasing this correctly. Can you help me? Because sexual awakening and forbidden sexuality has so much of the weight of this narrative, so much of its shock is in the resonances of people touching what they should not touch. And so many of the pleasures of the book come with accepting very basic bodily functions, peeing and defecating, are actions for the children that this book pays more attention to than most do, and the children are at home with them.
Right. Well, I think one of the things I like to think is that the book is about intimacy, you know, and it's not just forbidden. It's not just forbidden love, but it's also you know, love between siblings when they are children, or the way they love and touch and sleep next to their mother, and. And what is so interesting about this kind of tactile, you know, these tactile feelings are that they stray between being acts of assurance and innocence, and suddenly become dangerous. And the rules are so palpable, and yet hard for anybody who isn't just accepting of them to understand that, you know, as a child or as children, Estepan and Rahel love Velita, and if you do that and you do not accept the wisdom that you mustn't touch this man or you mustn't go near him, it doesn't make any sense. To a child, why not? You know, how is it possible to explain to a child that, oh, he's an untouchable? It's, you know, and any such explanation would be ridiculous to a child. But there is wisdom that's because there is some kind of wisdom in innocence, in the child. And so I think I see the book as something, as a book about intimacy and human, that human ability to love so deeply and yet to be so brutal and so irrationally brutal towards each other. And as children, I think again, children don't. It's not that they want to break the rules; they just don't know them, you know. And where at what age do you start thinking that, oh, you know, you shouldn't talk about peeing or defecating, or it's just something that you do.
Now, my sense is that what happens after the final page of this book, since we've been warned throughout that this is a viable, diable age that Rahel is at, that beyond this vision of absolute love is the death of the two children, and that what the book wants to leave us with is love, but to know horribly that were the book to continue for only three pages more, we would be without them. And so the agony and fear that accompanies the reader throughout the book is there even on its final page. We're at the precipice, yes?
Well, I guess truly, you know, in a way they have already died. You know, they have lost, when I keep referring to them as quietness and emptiness. And the, you know, again, when Estepan and Rahel are together, again, as grown-ups, what they share is grief. You know, it's not sex, it's not incest, it's none of these things. It's just that which they can share with nobody else. It's just grief, which they cannot lay down because it isn't theirs to give away. And to me, as a person who lives in India, I feel that all the time, that I'm grieving someone else's grief, because you're living in a place where such terrible things happen, and you must take that responsibility, and sometimes there's nothing you can do about it, and there's a sense, there is that sense of timelessness, and that this civilization will end sometime, and it's a very small amount of time in the age of the earth, and so on. But at the same time, on a smaller scale of time, you are aware of what the rest of humanity around you is going through, and to me, that's what is really important, that as children they witnessed this terrible thing, but they also participated in it. And even as adults, sometimes you feel the helplessness of a child living in that country, because you know that you are participating in it in some way.
I'm speaking to Arundhati Roy, the author of The God of Small Things, a novel published by Random House. Now, recently I attended a writing conference in Cambridge. People from around the world were invited for 11 days to Cambridge University. And it was interesting because although there were two Americans, there was one Canadian, there were five Indian writers, young writers there, to hear the works of contemporary British writers. I became friendly with them, and when the book came up, something that was very interesting happened. Fierce envy, enormous. And then as I watched them, Rushir and Jeet, deal with other books, there was a lot of very harsh dismissal. Oh, that is synthetic magic realism. Or, oh, that there seemed to be an enormous ferocity. Is that true of the writing scene in India? I mean,
it's really it's amazing. You know, what it is that India is poised in a very strange place just now. Okay, on the one hand, we're sort of trying to celebrate our 50th anniversary of independence. It's a nation that's trying to shrug off the legacy of colonialism. On the other hand, just a few years ago, the Indian economy opened up and welcomed, you know, MTV and Coca-Cola and whatever. And so you're trying to reject something and accept something, and there's a very narrow difference between those two things. And there is a lot of fierce argument, sometimes intellectually exhilarating, charged, you know, and vital about what is right and what is wrong.
Yes.
And the fact is that there can never be any consensus. And when you're a writer, you grow up in this atmosphere of, it's almost vicious, you know, and you must accept. I knew that was what I would be letting myself in for. But the thing is that you just have to look at it positively as something that sharpens your wits, you know, and the truth is that, for instance, you take the case of my book. Actually, the book was, for the lack of a more sophisticated word, discovered by an Indian editor. And the whole excitement began in India. It was first published in India. But people want to believe that that wasn't how it happened. People want to believe that, oh, it started in the West. And then what happens is that if you're not a success in the West, you're a failure. But if you are a success, you're attacked for that.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in the case of, you know, Salman Rushdie just made this statement which has made it
galvanized
everyone,
and
yes,
angered,
yeah,
that there is no serious literature in dialect.
Exactly.
Yes.
Now something like that, you know, I think it's such a cruel and unnecessary thing to have said.
Why would he have said that?
I have no idea, you know, except that I just don't know. But the thing is that what happens, you know, is that it sets off this horrible, self-righteous and unnecessary debate amongst people. And I say that, look, as far as I'm concerned, a writer governs language. Language doesn't govern me. And you must not divide literature according to language. You divide it according to stories, you know, or what stories it tells. But the thing is that if you look at vernacular writing, the writers that whose names people will use to refute Rushdie's statement, all of them are probably over 60. Because of this vicious climate, you know, where everybody's put down, young people are not encouraged. There's this whole debate about who has the right to represent India.
Mm-hmm.
Literature seen as propaganda. You're told you're not showing India in a proper light. That's the favorite term that they use, you know. These are not issues that you should write about. This is only because the West wants to hear this. But ultimately, in that noise, you have to just make your own decisions. You have to know India as a country has, we flinch because for so many years we have been defined by the West.
Now, I wanted to ask you, there are certain sequences where the world starts to make noises in The God of Small Things. In particular, it's not just the natural world, the industrial world, as at the airport, with its waste paper basket, cement, kangaroos. There's all sorts of trumpeting sounds being made. And I thought of James Joyce, and I wondered whether Joyce was an important writer for you.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, he's a writer. I think he's just a huge, big influence. Even though I have to say that there are parts of Ulysses that I will read like a Bible, you know, and I haven't read the whole of Ulysses.
Yes, yes. It's the same here.
Yeah, but I think so.
But again, I noticed something culturally strange. that the people who were writing about this book in America look at the hyphenate words, and instead of saying, oh, James Joyce gave us Knot Green or Scrotum Tightening, they say, oh, there's this tendency in this book to combine, as if this weren't the habit of the greatest avant-garde work in the century, as if they wanted to believe somehow that an Indian writer would not have been influenced by that work.
Well, exactly. You know, that's why I say so many, whenever people, you know, when in doubt with an Indian writer, invoke Rushdie. That's what they do. And it's as if you're from India, you must be writing magic realism, you know. Whereas, though what I will say is that, you know, a lot of us from India do speak more than one language. Like, I speak Malayalam and Hindi as well. I could not write a novel in either of those two languages, but I do speak them. And there is this, you know, in Malayalam, for instance, we do join words. And I do think that sometimes speaking more than one language breaks language down and makes it worse, makes all three worse. But sometimes it enhances a language. And I mean, you know, it doesn't matter where it comes from, whether it's Joyce or whether it's from my you know, other language. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But
the children notice, or rather are told, that Malayalam is spelled the same way front and backwards, and they begin to read words forwards and backwards, and they have, in a sense, they're searching for a message that the world wants to reveal. The airport world, the theater world, these have sort of darker messages than the insect world and the world of smaller and smaller things. Almost as if the dancers in the temple do speak the language of the insects, but they have been performing at a local hotel where they are abridging their stories more and more, and their performances, instead of lasting days, will last a single hour, will be like commercials. And it's almost as if one needs the time and the silence to hear the more interesting unspoken words, yes?
Well, I can often think that it's like to ask somebody to come and perform Kathakali for 1 hour is like going and saying, can I have, you know, 1 square inch of that Van Gogh, please? You know, it's the equivalent of that. It's as Philistine as doing that. But I don't know that the children are looking for hidden messages in their reading backward. It's just, you know, sometimes we just don't realize how rule-bound we are. You know, even when you think you're free, you're actually being rattled around in a can. And when there isn't a can, you do things like reading backwards or, you know, just pushing at the boundaries of things, the way children fiddle, you know, the way they will fiddle with things, with plugs and switches and anything. Just, it's a kind of exploration more than a search for any hidden message. Really, that's what it is about. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned the insects because friends of mine who read the book say, you know, on every page there's the underlife. You know, there are, again, those creatures who have different rules, you know, that overlap into territories and make you once again aware of the fact that there are so many things happening simultaneously, which is why I'm always struggling against this need that people have to simplify and define things.
I wanted to end by noticing, oddly, that both this book, The God of Small Things by my guest Arundhati Roy, and the book In the Skin of a Lion by Michael Andaja share an epigraph. That epigraph is from John Berger, and I'll read it, and I'd like to talk about it a bit in closing, because I stopped and I said, wait, this has been the epigraph of another book I've read very recently. It's Berger saying, never again will a single story be told as though it's the only one. Now, first of all, do you know where he says that? I was curious.
In Ways of Seeing, I think.
And yeah. What led you to be attracted to it?
Well, exactly what I was saying earlier. You know, this struggle that I am continuing against simplification, where in the book you see that each character comes to it with a story, and therefore, you know, whether it's baby Kochama who does reprehensible things, or Comrade Pilla, or whoever it is, that you cannot actually stand on some preordained moral ground and judge them, because the minute you do, something about them reveals that you're not really allowed to do that with people and with the stories they bring and intertwine into other people's stories. So whether it's the characters in this book, or whether it's the structure of the book, which is a story by itself, or whether it's the underlife, which are going about their own business, the beetles and the cockroaches and the fish, there is not a single story that can be told from one single position. That's what I meant.
Why is that good? Because, you know, at one time it was said that art imposed this order on life and that it arrived at a kind of truth. This kind of book wants to shred and make multiple that truth and to say that, yes, there will never be a final truth, and the more selfish people are, the more they will insist on a single truth.
Well, I can't use the word good or bad. You know, it just is for me. And I think that it's a, you know, it's just a philosophy that doesn't lend itself to neat administration, because it would be very simple for all of us if we did believe that there were 10 commandments and there was the truth, you know, whereas I don't accept that system, which I think is good administration but bad philosophy.
I've been speaking to Arundhati Roy, the author of The God of Small Things, her first novel published by Random House. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.